Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Mr. and Mrs. Murphy, thank you for coming, the director of the nursery school began. We thought we should share with you some of our observations about your son, Raymond. He seems to be in his own little world, his teacher, Mrs. Grover, noted. When the other children approach him, he never responds, and when I talk to him, he usually looks at me as though he doesn't understand me at all. She looked at them quizzically. Does he show any of this behavior at home? The Murphys looked at each other and nodded, their faces grim. Have you had his hearing tested? The director asked gently.
Oh, we know his hearing is fine, Mr. Murphy responded, since he comes running from anywhere in the house when his favorite TV show is on.
And he loves to go to the window to watch, Mrs. Murphy added, when the trash truck pulls up. Well, then, said the director softly, glancing at Mrs. Murphy, who was biting her lower lip and pulling a tissue out of her purse. It might be a good idea to talk to your pediatrician. Raymond may be showing signs of autism. From a parent's perspective, what should we know about this condition? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Today, we are fortunate enough to have two experts back with us to continue our conversation about childhood autism, Dr. C.T. Gordon, a child psychiatrist, and his wife, Mrs. Edie Gordon, will talk with us about autism and, in particular, about their own experience raising an autistic child.
We're picking up our story about the Gordon son, Zach, when he was just beginning to get some help from Dr. Lovaas's ABA program.
We started Zachary in an ABA program when he was about 5 and a half. And the reason why we didn't start about him earlier in that is because we didn't know about it.
The interesting thing about the ABA program for Zach, though, is that it was nearly a complete failure within the first couple of months because Zachary had no receptive language. And at that time, the program was totally based on a child having some receptive language. It was a receptively based program.
In the program, they actually do receptive language drills as well as expressive language drills. You essentially do these drills at a table with a one-on-one, you know, arrangement where you have the therapist on one side of the table and the child on the other side of the table. He would look when the therapist would call his name, say, Zachary, come here. He learned to be very compliant because that's step one in the program, is to teach the child to come when you call the child. He would look across the table and he would see, and he would know immediately that that was going to be a visual drill that wasn't going to require him having to understand auditorily what was going to be said. It was only going to require vision, and he would come immediately. But when he saw that it was going to be a receptive drill, his behavior immediately showed. He did not want to participate. He knew it was going to be hard for him. He was and still is a very anxious kid, and performance anxiety is a major stumbling block for him. And he just would not come to the table without a lot of prompting. And so he was coming to the table, but he knew it was frustration. He wasn't going to win. He wasn't going to be able to succeed at this task. And so what happened was we felt very strongly that we weren't going to bring him to the table and not succeed. We needed to spend more time in the visual, nonverbal drills than in the auditory receptive drills. And so that's what we did. We ended up modifying the drills and made them to be visual drills instead of receptive. And he was happy. And he was learning. And it was amazing how motivated he was.
Can you give an example of what a visual drill is? I know people are listening. They're thinking, all right, so how do you do this? What is that?
Like, for example, let's say you had an apple on the table, and you start very, very simple. These are very small, bite-sized steps that you start with, and you reinforce positively every time the child would get it correct. You'd have an apple on the table, and instead of my saying to Zach, touch apple, where he had only his ears to tell him what was on the table, which he didn't understand, you would actually hold up the card that either had the picture of the apple with the word under it, or depending on at what level of skill they are, you might just have the word or you may just have the picture. So you would hold up the picture, and then he just essentially knew what it was by visual matching. And so almost everything that we taught him was first done through a visual matching paradigm. And it was amazing. We deduced fairly quickly that he actually was, unlike other children, he was actually picking up more on the words than he was on the picture. So although you may start with one object on the table, you get to the point where you're putting two and three objects on the table. So an apple, a banana, and an orange. You hold up the word card banana, and he looks and he reads B-A-N-A-N-A. And then he was able to pick up the banana. Versus nothing in front of him, just my voice that says, touch banana. And he had to discriminate that word among the three items on the table. He could not do. He could not do it. And we, again, you know, because he loved the Disney thing, we would have Disney characters on the table, Disney pictures, even in the things that he loved. He could not discriminate auditorily, but you could hold up word after word after word. He learned so quickly the reading.
He probably learned 300 or 400 sight words in a month or two.
Mm-hmm. It's so remarkable. Once you discovered how he learned, mm-hmm. then he could learn. He could communicate. Right.
What really blew my mind with that was the expressive aspect. I thought, okay, he's hyperlexic. That means reading before your years. Lots of kids are, especially kids in the autism spectrum. I thought, well, this is great. And it's often considered a splinter skill, you know. And I thought, but is he going to be able to use this to communicate? Mm-hmm. You know, is he going to be able to take those words that he knows how to spell? One, does he know the meaning of them? And two, will he be able to use them to expressively communicate something in a functional way? And it just blew my mind. It was almost effortless how he picked up the pen and just started writing very neatly. So he was ready. He did that beautifully without any problem. Edie taught him within a week how to make all his letters, and he would just write the words. And we very quickly went
so
to typing.
It was so hungry to learn and to be able to communicate. It was unbelievable.
In all his free time then, like she was saying earlier, that's what he would do. He would go grab the materials and he would practice. He would
– when we were doing the LOVAS program, you actually essentially did 2 3-hour sessions a day. So he had 3 hours in the morning, and then he'd have an hour or two break, and then 3 hours in the afternoon. Well, between that hour or two when he's supposed to have a break, you would hear him. He'd be downstairs pulling out the bins, setting up the drills himself, self-teaching. He just was hungry to understand.
And how old was he at that point?
Well, we started when he was 5 1/2, and so it was quickly.
It was right away.
It was right across the summer. And we were trying to make a decision as to whether or not in the fall we were actually going to put him in a school program or have him home full time doing the home program. And we just decided over that short period of time there was no way a school could keep up the pace that with which he was eager to learn and desirous to learn. So we knew we had to keep him at home.
I have to ask you how in the world you did this with two other children, even at that beginning stage.
It was so difficult because, you know, we alluded a little bit to our oldest one's difficulties, and they continued. I mean, he continued to be very obsessive. He had a lot of anxiety, but he was very precocious. And my husband would tell me about his language, how unusual it was and advanced it was. And, you know, social difficulties. But he managed to get into nursery school and to get through the nursery school years. And Kelly, our youngest, I just carried on my hip. She just lived there.
While you did all this.
She really just lived there.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, in the early years.
And then right around the time when Zach was 5 1/2, when we were doing this home program and he was starting to learn to communicate, Chip was actually in elementary school, and he turned out he's severely dyslexic and he couldn't read at all. And he had his own frustration from that. So we're dealing with that too. And our daughter's dyslexic as well. And interestingly, dyslexia is one of the things that clearly runs in the family of mm-hmm. people with autism. It does in ours.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion about childhood autism.
Two excellent books written by hosts Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, are available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. C.T. Gordon and Mrs. Edie Gordon about autism in childhood.
I do want to go back because there's one thing that we didn't make very clear, and that is when Zachary was in preschool, he was 3, 4, and 5, he actually had an opportunity to participate in a study that a woman was doing for her doctoral dissertation, and The program was called Natural Aided Language Stimulation. And in that program, you actually use the picture symbols, which are pictures that represent objects in the environment. And they were using them somewhat in Zachary's preschool program. But what she had told us was she came to the house and she said, we need to design a language board. And we need to design it around something that Zachary's highly motivated. And so for him, I thought, well, it's either going to be Disney or foods. Mm-hmm. So what we decided was we would make a placemat for him so it would be centered around the eating. She told me that we had to have, I think it was 12 pictures in order to encourage communication. And we were talking about communication that would be both expressive, meaning him pointing and showing us what he wants, what his desires and needs were, as well as receptive, that is, what we were wanting from him or asking of him. So it was a two-way system for teaching communication. And so I looked at my oldest, my youngest, and I remember one night, we were looking through these books of these picture symbols. And she said, now you got to pick out, you know, about 12. You don't want to have too many, but you have to have just enough so that you can have essentially subject, verb, object sentences that you would be building up to. And I thought, well, Zachary, I know we'll get bored very easily if we only have a few number of these. And at that point, we're talking cutting and pasting, not like you can do it on the computer mm-hmm. now. So I said, well, we started going through them. Well, he knows this one. This is something he eats. This is something he eats. He doesn't eat this. You know, I want to put stuff on there about, you know, utensils and plates and cups and whatever. So we started. His first board had 81 pictures on it. And she was really skeptical. And she said, oh, I think this is going to be too much. And I said, I don't think so. She would come and she would videotape us around the dinner table. And it was unbelievable. Within such a short period of time, I think she has it documented, within a two-week period of time, he was already stringing three pictures together in a small sentence to communicate, you know, I want crackers. And then we, in return, you know, in order to encourage the communication, might say, by pointing, what do you want? So that he not only was the one in charge of saying what he wanted, but he also had to pay attention to what we were saying back to him or asking back of him. And it was just amazing. He was all over that board within a short period of time. And so that sort of, you know, gave us some additional motivation to really push and to keep moving with him.
Now, is he making verbal sounds at this point at all?
After he showed us that he could write, and essentially, for the most part, we started that on a chalkboard. I know Dr. Gordon had talked about, you know, using a utensil. We actually were using chalkboard because that was big and easy for him to manipulate. Well, then, you know, the chalkboard was downstairs, and I could have chalkboards all over the house. But what I did was I got those little dry erase boards, and we used those, you know, dry erase markers because I could have one of those in the kitchen. You know, when you're communicating, that happens fast, that process. And he was already frustrated because he was thinking much faster than he could even write. But you didn't want to say, oh, wait a minute, I got to go find the dry erase board or the marker or the pen or whatever. So it was clear to me that we had to ease that frustration by making things available to him as quick as possible. And then we got to thinking, well, if he can write so clearly and that's not fast enough, maybe we could teach him to type. And so we went on this search for a device that, again, could be handy, portable, right there at any time. And that was really difficult. I mean, we were still plugged into the public school system, and I was asking the what's called the augmentative communication people who know about these devices, what do you have? What do you have? What can we use? You know, I need something fast, portable. We can take it everywhere with us because we take our voices with us all the time. He needed something that he could have all the time. And although the picture boards were working, he was faster, and he needed more, and, he, you know, I couldn't keep up with the pictures as fast as his language and his brain was processing. So eventually, a patient came into my husband's office, and I think this was a child with learning disabilities mm-hmm. in Fairfax County mm-hmm. Public Schools, and he had this little device. And my husband called me up out of the basement, come here, I think we found just what you were looking for. And it was called an Alpha Smart, which is really just a small device where you can do word processing. And it shows four lines on the screen. And I thought, wow, this is cool. And so we got Zach and Alpha Smart. Well, we not only got him one, we ended up quickly getting 4, 5, and 6 of them so we could have them all over the house. And we never went out of the house without it. Initially, we started, we actually had his communication board because he was learning to spell. And, you know, you wanted to have words in front of him that he could pull from a vocabulary list, let's say. And so we took the boards with us, and he learned to type so fast. We were just amazed. And it was the same thing as when we started the early Lobosch years. In between working and whatever school drills we were doing, he would be up in his room with his Disney book propped up, and we had a word processor up there. And he was just typing right out of the book, all this Disney stuff. It was just amazing.
Thrilled. He must have been so thrilled with these new ways to reach out and be able to communicate. Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
I'll never forget this was kind of a landmark for me, but I consider his first social conversation was one day we were on the way home from a Cub Scout hiking day with my oldest son, and I took Zach along with the pack up in the mountains. And he was 7 at the time, Zach was, and the other boys were 9, the age of my older one. And for an hour, continuously, he typed back and forth to the other boys, who at that age were just really enamored by the whole device and the fact that the little kid could type that fast and he couldn't talk. And they joked back and forth for like an hour, and he was laughing and they were laughing. It was great. So that for him did become a mode of communication that he could use very functionally. And he still uses it that way. Even though he's 12 now and he can talk, he started talking some when he was 10, he can still express himself much better through writing or typing than he can through speaking, and likewise receptively.
Right. So.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion about childhood autism.
For an audio cassette copy of Any Parent's Perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. C.T. Gordon and Mrs. Edie Gordon about autism.
So the typing, we actually started with him around age 6. And again, he still did not have receptive language. He did not process what we were saying to him auditorily. So whenever we wanted to communicate with him or ask him things, we had to type, and then he would read it, and then he had to type back. And that's how we lived for 3.5 more years, I guess. And then when he was about 8.5, one of his typing devices that lives in the kitchen, it's the more expensive one because it has voice output. So whatever he types, he could hear it. Well, he had never gravitated to that one because the voice output never meant anything. So he would take the Alpha Smart without the voice output, because that one he could carry all over the house. The Link, which is the one with the voice output, I had that one plugged into the wall, sitting on the counter in the kitchen. One day I was standing in the kitchen washing dishes, and he was over there typing on the device. And I heard the same sentence over and over again, and I remember thinking, well, that's unusual. First, that he's typing on that one, and second, that he's typing the same sentence over and over again. I turned around and looked, and he actually had his ear down on the device. And I thought, oh, my gosh, it's happening. And he actually was starting to process the language.
He was recognizing
it was actually
that what he was
happening.
Typing was that sound.
And I don't know. Gosh. It was, you know, really within weeks, I would say, that we could give him simple commands just auditorily without having to hold up a word card or to point or to actually take his hand and follow through. You know, get your shoes or something, and he would go get them. And I would say the stress level in the house, you could feel it start to decrease. Hmm. It was amazing.
We've been talking a lot about communication, and indeed, that is at the very core of autism. And I think that it actually causes a lot of the symptomatology that we look at as being primary to autism. Like a lot of their difficulty connecting socially is because of their language. It's not really an innate problem socially. I don't like to view autism as a social disorder. And it's one of the myths and the misunderstandings about autism where I see misdiagnoses most is that doctors will say, well, this kid can't be autistic because he relates. He had a lot of anxiety when he separated from his mother in the waiting room. He's really connected to her. Well, autistic kids are normally connected. I mean, they lie along a range, a spectrum, just like all kids. But autism is not a problem with basic connection and attachment. I think that even in the classroom and in our special education settings, that nowadays this severe communication problem in autism isn't appreciated enough. I think in a general sense that kids are felt to be much less intelligent than what they really are, that mental retardation in autism is overdiagnosed because of this severe communication piece. And can give a good example with our own son, Zachary. He was tested by a couple different psychologists at age 5 before he had a communication system. And of course, he was deemed to be profoundly mentally retarded. He couldn't do anything on the IQ tests, which were verbally based IQ tests, nor would he cooperate at that point on the nonverbal IQ tests, although they didn't try any. But if they would have, I don't think they would have gotten very far anyway. At age 7, once we had worked with him in such a way through the ABA technique that he was predictable and compliant and would answer, and he had a communication system, that is, the reading and writing system was in place at that point, he was tested with 3 different IQ tests to cross-validate each other through the visual route. Instead of being asked questions, he was typed questions or written them, and he typed his answers. He scored normally on all 3 tests in a very close range. So it's just a word of encouragement to parents and to educators to focus on this educational piece.
Right. So I think what happens is they tend to look at our children and they want to focus on behavior. And they say to themselves, we have to get this child's behavior under control before we can teach him or her anything. And really, in my opinion, that's backwards. Mm-hmm. They need to give the child something to work with. The means of communication has to be there first before you can talk about, you know, how they're acting and how they're responding and what they're doing and what they should be doing, what they shouldn't be doing.
A lot of misbehavior comes out of communication frustration and not being able to communicate, too.
And anxiety at not being able to communicate.
One question that I'm sure a lot of people are thinking right now is, all right, we understand about the early years. What happens to these kids down the line? What happens when they're teenagers? What happens when they're adults?
Well, first of all, I just want to make the point that I've seen major gains in terms of language and in terms of socialization well beyond the points that kids are supposed to show them. You'll read in textbooks that what language a child has at age 5 or 6 is what they're going to have. Well, our child didn't have any language at age 5 or 6 and started developing receptive language at age 8 and started talking at age 10. And I've seen other kids who have begun talking or greatly advanced in their language during adolescence. So continue to be optimistic. Continue to work with the kids well into adulthood. I think that we don't know what difference all the early intervention from the last 10 years or so, where it's been much more prominently done, what difference that's going to make. I really believe it's going to have a major impact and change the course of autism. I think that kids as adults will be more independent, will be able to live more independently, will be able to work more independently in the future. But we really have very little information.
So there is some hope. Parents should
be
totally panicked.
I think there's a lot of hope.
What resources would you suggest for parents who might want to learn a little bit more about autism?
I was going to suggest 3 resources. They're both national organizations in the United States. The first is FEAT, FEAT. It stands for Families for Early Autism Treatment. This is a group that focuses on diagnosis in young children and getting kids appropriate early intervention, especially ABA programs. There are state and local chapters of FEAT, but the national office is in Sacramento, California, and the phone number is 916-843-1536.
Can you repeat that while people are running for their pencils?
916-843-1536. They all have also have a website at www.feet.org. The second resource that I was going to give is the Autism Society of America. This is a group that predominantly focuses on support of parents, education of parents. And I have a 1-800 number, which is 1-800-3-AUTISM.
Okay. Want to say that again?
800-3-AUTISM, autism. And their website is www.autism-society.org. And finally, I'd like to give the reference for an organization that Edie and I have been personally involved with from the beginning. That's the National Alliance for Autism Research. This is an organization that's dedicated to promoting and funding biomedical research in autism. We fund science at universities throughout the United States and abroad, and we're just starting the big genetics project I mentioned earlier in the show in conjunction with Autism Society of America and the MIND Institute, M-I-N-D Institute in California. We started an autism tissue program so that people can sign up to donate their autistic family member's brain tissue when that member dies. And that's tremendously helpful to research, because that's been a real rate-limiting step in research, is being able to directly study the brains of people with autism. In the first 3 years of the Autism Tissue Project, we've already tripled the number of brains that have been studied throughout history and have learned a lot from that. They have a great newsletter that comes out every few months that people can be kept up on what's going on in the research world with. And that phone number is 888-777-NAAR.
Okay. Want to give that one more time?
That's 888-777-NAAR. That's N-A-A-R. The website is www.naar.org.
Well, we are so grateful to have been able to talk to both of you about a subject that's baffling and frightening, and you have given so much hope and information to all of the parents and adults listening. So thank you very much, Dr. C.T. Gordon and Mrs. Edie Gordon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our book, Washington, D.C. with Kids. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and mention show 161. Tell us, if you can, what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you are tuning into. Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids are both available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents' Perspective and our books Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, http://i.am/parentsperspective. That's http://i.am/parentsperspective. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.